Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're welcome to Liveline. Cullum O'Mungine here. If you want to get in contact from the north or abroad, 08457 853333. You can contact us on WhatsApp, 087 484 8888, 51551 for your text, joe@rte.ie for your emails, or 0818715815. Now, people have been hearing in the news over the last while that in the last 24 hours, a majorly influential figure in Irish life, and that's not an overstatement, has died in the last 24 hours, and that's Michael O'Brien, who passed away. He is attributed with by an eminent historian with changing the course of the country's response to the Ryan report into institutional abuse. He himself was in Ferry House Industrial School, and he spoke very eloquently about this on Questions and Answers in May 2009. But the historian Carol Holohan says in an analysis of this that it was the turning point in the public response to the Ryan report. She says, in a controlled rage, this older man from rural Ireland articulated a deep sense of pain and anguish that 2,600 ugly pages of a report could never capture. And people remember in May 2009, Michael O'Brien speaking from the audience, looked directly at the then Minister for Education, Noel Dempsey, and he was supported as he spoke by his wife, Mary, who sat beside him, a dignified source of support for him. He paid tribute to her for saving his life throughout the years that he had suffered with the trauma of his experiences in the industrial school in Ferry House. Let's just hear what Michael O'Brien said back in 2009.
First of all, Mr. Minister, you made a bags of it in the beginning by changing the judges. You made a complete bags of it at that time, because I went to the Lafoy Commission and you had seven barristers there questioning me and telling them I was telling lies when I told them that I got raped of a Saturday, got a merciful beating after it, and then he came along the following morning and put Holy Communion in my mouth. You don't know what happened there. You haven't the foggies, you're talking through your hat there, and you're talking to a Fianna Fáil man, a former councillor, a former mayor. You're talking to that what tooth and nail for you for the party that you're talking about now. You didn't do it right. You got it wrong. Admit it. And apologise for doing that. Because you don't know what I feel inside me. You don't know the hurt I am. You said it was non-adversarial. My God. Seven barristers throwing questions at us non-stop. I attempted to commit suicide. There's the woman who saved me from committing suicide on my way down from Dublin after spending 5 days at the commission. 5 days I spent at the commission. They brought a man over from Rome, 90-odd years of age, to tell me I was telling lies, that I wasn't beaten for an hour, non-stop, by two of them, non-stop. From head to toe without a shred of cloth on my body. My God, Minister. And now, could I speak to you and ask your leader, would you stop making a political football of this? You hurt us when you do that. You tear the shreds from inside our body. For God's sake, try and give us some peace. Try and give us some peace and not to continue hurting us. That woman will tell you how many times I jump out of the bed at night with the sweat pumping out of me. Because I see these fellas at the end of the bed with their fingers doing that to me and pulling me into the room to rape me, to bugger me, and bait the shite out of me. That's the way it is. You know what? Sometimes I listen to the leader of Fianna Fáil. I even listen to the apology. It was mealy-mouthed, but at least it was an apology. At least it was an apology. The Rosminians said in the report, they said they were easy on us. The first day I went to the Rosminians, in my home, which is Ferry House in Clonmel, because it's the only home I know, he said, you're in it for the money. We didn't want money. We didn't want money. We wanted someone to stand up and say, yes, these fellas were buggered. These people were robbed. Little girls, my sister, a month old when she was put into an institution. 8 of us from the one family, dragged by the ISPCC clergyman, put into two cars, brought to the court in Clonmel, left standing there without food or anything. And the fellow in the long black frock and the white collar came along and he put us into a van, not a van, a scut truck. I don't know what you call it now. A scut truck. And landed us below with 200 other boys. 2 nights later, I was raped.
Michael O'Brien there speaking in May 2009. And that intervention with the searing honesty and born of very cruel, brutal, traumatic experience changed the course of the public response, as you heard there before that clip from, as Carol Holland said. And many or more people did come forward and took courage from that and brought their own experiences into the public domain. And he continued to campaign right up until even the papal visit to Ireland in 2018. He questioned government as to whether or not he could be given leave to be free of the non-disclosure clause that he had been forced to sign when testifying to the Lafoy Commission. He wanted to name his abuser. He wanted to say how much compensation he had got because he said he didn't care who knew and he wanted his abuser, who had died, to be named and not to be protected with the anonymity. And it should be said, as I say, that his wife sat beside him, supported him. He paid tribute to her. She, Mary, has predeceased. And of course, our condolences go out to the family and to anyone who is affected by the issues that affected Michael O'Brien and who went through similar trauma. Or if that brings up anything for you, you can go to rte.ie/helplines. It is also interesting, and it's pointed out as well by Carol Holohan, that the question that John Bowman asked in follow-up to Michael to that piece by Michael O'Brien was why he hadn't reported it in earlier life. And he said because he would have been made an outcast. So there was obviously a lot of social pressure and he had to bear that burden in a very lonely way until he was able to bring it to light and bring it to light so publicly and so viscerally on Questions and Answers in 2009. Councillor Richie Molloy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, O'Connor, and your listeners.
And our condolences, of course, to the family of Michael O'Brien. You knew Michael, you know the family.
I do, or I did, Callum, and I suppose I do want to offer my sympathies to the O'Brien family, you know, because it's a sad day for them, and even though their dad reached a great age, 92, you know, he's still their dad. And I think the fact that, listening to those words again on that interview, it would send a chill down your spine, really and truly, to hear that over again. And I suppose for Michael O'Brien at that time, and while I didn't serve with him on the council, you know, I'm on the council later in life in 2004, I would have known him as a Clonmel man. And at that time, I suppose, when he spoke out, he probably spoke for a lot of people that probably wouldn't have been able to be as articulate as himself. And at another stage, memory serves me, he set up an office in Clonmel to kind of help people, you know, apply for redress at the time, because I'd say he had, by making that speech on the night on RTE, it brought him to national prominence and it probably gave other people the courage to speak out. Because, you know, in that time too, it was difficult to speak out against church and state. You know, you would feel very sorry for people that ended up in those institutions at the time and they were really voiceless as such.
And when do you remember watching Questions and Answers back in 2009?
I do it like when I heard it again on the clip there, and I listened to it there last night. You know, I suppose memory over time, but when you hear it again, when it describes exactly what happened to him, like it was shocking, really. And you can imagine, like, for all his entire family sent down. And I remember Ferry House at the time in Clonmel as a young lad. And from my memory of it, it was a place kind of surrounded by high walls. But really, the people in the town wouldn't have really known what went on there. All you knew was that people maybe that were orphans, or I think some of it was a detention centre as well at the time. And the young lads from Ferrius would go to the schools in Clonmel. But you wouldn't know much of their life at that time.
And did you know Michael had been there?
I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have actually known that until he said it on the programme that night. You know, because I only knew him as a politician, and, you know, he was a former mayor of the town. He was very proud, you know, very, very proud of the morality. And I probably should say that in tomorrow morning, his funeral takes place in Clonmel, and he'll be afforded, you know, a guard of honour by the local councillors in robes and that, you know, as befitting his position at the time. And it's a chance for the town of Clonmel, I suppose, to pay their tribute to the late Michael O'Brien.
Yeah,
but
no,
he was a very brave man. You know, it definitely took a lot of courage at that time to stand up and to tell your own personal story.
And I suppose not only to speak out on national television, which shouldn't be underestimated, to speak out on any subject, but for something so personal and so traumatic. But as you say, to set up effectively an outreach centre for other survivors to come forward and relate that experience and to help them through that process took remarkable courage on his part to help people who'd suffered similar experiences.
Absolutely. Yeah, like as a public representative, he really, you know, took his job seriously. He would have been an army man. He would have been a soldier in the Kickham Army Barracks in Clonmel at the time, and there would have been a number of soldiers, from my memories of it, that served in Kickham Barracks that might have been also in Ferryhus for a number of years. So I know he definitely helped people from that era, and I suppose setting up the office in itself was a huge thing, because I suppose it's often hard for us all to remember what Ireland was like back at that time. You know, I suppose church and state were the authority figures. Very, very difficult to challenge them. And you only have to look at that grace, you know, the story of grace that the reporters finally issued there a couple of days ago with that young lady. And, you know, there again, like years and years later, and no real conclusion to it, you know. So it probably brings all that out into the open, all these things that happened in the past and nobody spoke up.
He did a great service to the town of Clonmel by telling people what went on behind those walls, how he'd ended up there, the experience of his family, and then reaching out to help other people.
Absolutely, because that was when he met that night on questions and answers, that was kind of the first time, when I'm looking back now, that I can remember so vivid. And, you know, there's been so many atrocities brought out afterwards, you know. And thinking of Philomena, you know, the Philomena was it, the lady in Rosscrea, that wrote child had been buried in Rosscrea, and the nuns hadn't taught her, you know, the way she searched.
Well, he was put up for adoption, and in from Shanros Abbey, and he sought to get in contact with her, and that had been concealed from her.
That had been concealed. So, you know, there was like right across Ireland, really. I suppose no more than lots of countries, I suppose, but in that era, people suffered terribly, and it took great men, you know, say, like Michael O'Brien, or women, like, it, you know, the term whistleblowers, he was now, Maurice McCabe was another man there with the, you know, the, all the traffic time, you know, the way the Maurice McCabe story was so difficult to bring to the fore, like, you're taking on powerful institutions, and very difficult. And Michael O'Brien, you know, at that stage of his life, you know, he was an oldish man, even then, when he spoke on RT.
And did people talk to him about it afterwards? Because sometimes, you know, Irish people can be awkward around very emotional subjects, whether that's illness or trauma or that. Do you think people spoke to him about it? Do you think people thanked him for what he'd done, or paid tribute to him, or even just said a quiet fair play to you?
Yeah, I think they would have done it in a quiet way, to be honest with you. Because Clonmel, at the end of the day, is a town of, say, maybe 20,000 people. So it's not a massive town. You know, it's like, as you were saying, you know, he came from a rural area. And sometimes people don't like their stories being washed out in the national media. You know, and a lot of his family obviously still live in Clonmel. It won't be an easy time for them again this week to hear all that about their dad. But I suppose he felt himself that he had to speak out, not just for himself, but on behalf of all the other people that probably suffered at the hands. You know, and I'm always conscious myself personally, there was a lot of great religious people, but there was certainly a lot of bad eggs as well, you know, and that they were covered up over the years. And it's only right that now, you know, they're being exposed. But you can't forget the good as well. That's the other side of it, I suppose.
And Michael O'Brien's children, Geraldine, Peter, Martin and Katrina, who I suppose will be mourning their mother on the double again, as because she'd been such a support to Michael O'Brien over the years. He paid tribute to her. And on that night in questions and answers in 2009, people may have seen as she wiped a tear from her eye in pride at his intervention and his courage at relating his experience and taking the Minister for Education to task.
And very difficult, you know, because he would have been a Fianna Fáil man himself, you know, they would have been in the same party. And my recollection afterwards was that wouldn't have been prepared, you know. He didn't know, I suppose he was a member of the audience that night, but somehow, I suppose, listened to the, it was much to do with that Ryan report. It probably gave him the courage, and in fairness to the interviewer, you know, John Bowman, you know, he allowed him to, he gave him the space to say his piece. You know, there was sometimes in a live TV program, the interviewer wouldn't have been expecting that either. But I think it was very well handled on the night he got his chance to say his piece. And what happened afterwards, I don't know. But I think people of the town would have done it in a quiet way rather than, you know, coming out publicly, because he would have been one of the first people that I can remember at that time really coming out and describing it, you know, in such horrible terms. Like, you know, even when you think just what you've just played on, sure, you know, it would really shake you up. Like, wouldn't it? You could imagine someone at that age going in there, and who do you tell? You know, you're totally voiceless. And then going to, you know, as he said.
Well, Sandy, yeah. The experiences of other people who did report crimes that were perpetrated against them at the time found that they weren't investigated, and people, you know, didn't want to hear that particular truth at the time.
Possibly, yeah. And even this whole thing of signing these non-disclosures, and that still goes on to this day, you know, with the HSE, when people take them on sometimes. It's very unfair. It's like a gagging order, really, isn't it? You know, even when you're, if you've proved your case, you can still sometimes be gagged with those.
In the terms of a settlement where it doesn't go the full distance in a court case. We do have a clip from Michael O'Brien's Liveline interview in 2011, and this is him making an appeal. He was 2 years later still strongly campaigning and appealing to fellow victims to come forward and to relate their stories and to seek redress as well. Here he is in 2011.
And now, I was at the commission, and it was tough, but I got a chance to tell the story.
Yeah.
And that was the important thing. That is very important to survivors, a lot of survivors. They need to tell the story in the proper place. Everybody who is in an institution should have the right, the God-given right, to tell their story at a commission or in some other forum, mm-hmm, that can be reported back. People need to come forward. If a person needs to say something in of what happened to them as a child, an innocent child, whether in the case of a female raped, in the case of a male buggered, have the right to tell their story and should do it. And I appeal to people, wherever you can, tell your story.
And if you're affected, as I say, by anything Michael was raising there, rte.ie/helplines has some of the organisations that you might be able to get in touch with. Dr. Sinead Ring, Associate Professor in Law at Maynooth University. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
What Michael O'Brien said there on Questions and Answers in 2009, it's fair to say, it's a historic and important intervention in Ireland's public debate.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think he pierced the silence around child sexual abuse in a really important way. When the Ryan report came out, it was a really important time of public reckoning around the scale, the widespread nature of physical abuse and sexual abuse and emotional abuse in the industrial schools. But there was something about it that was almost overwhelming, I think, for people, that there was just, the numbers were so big and it was hard to kind of get to grips with it, I think, for people who aren't directly impacted by it. And I think that's what his voice does in that piece, in that clip, in that contribution. You can hear the emotion in his voice. You can see it on his face. You can see his wife next to him holding his hand and supporting him, and you can see the effort it's taking him to actually speak about his experience, but also the dignity and the power that's behind it when he's saying, you know, actually, I suffered rape, I suffered sexual abuse as a child in an industrial school, and people need to hear about it. And I just think, like, people often talk about child sexual abuse in the abstract, and it's very important, I think, for people who have experienced it to be heard. It might make it can be uncomfortable sometimes to listen to people's experiences, but it's absolutely essential that we do, as a society, really think about it and think about how we can do better as a society for survivors. You know, I have I have a course here at Maynooth, so I teach at Maynooth University, and we have a master's course in gendered violence on the stage, and we look at, you know, we look at the industrial schools and abuse in the industrial schools and abuse in the Magdalen laundries and the mother and baby homes. And we look at the state's responses in the various commissions. And I actually have Michael O'Brien's clip on the online page, you know, as a resource for the students. And we play it in class and we discuss it. And I think he really just brings it home to them how important it is that people are heard and properly listened to, and that they have like a right to tell their story and their experience.
And for communicating to students just how profound the level of trauma and isolation and harm from those institutions is. I mean, as you say, a report is 2,600 pages of text. Yeah. They may get some sense of it. But to see the impact on a human being where the suffering child is so visible.
Exactly.
All those years later, I mean, how important is that for Irish students to see?
It's absolutely essential, because there can be, if somebody hasn't been through it themselves, you know, it can be natural to assume that maybe with time, things kind of pass into the ether, or people get over it or whatever. But actually, if people aren't properly listened to and their experiences aren't honoured, they can be left with a feeling of deep devastation and trauma. And I think it's important that people are listened to by, you know, by society, and for my students to really understand the ongoing effects of child sexual abuse, that it can last, but also that people can also, you know, go on and make a contribution to society, as Michael O'Brien did, you know, he was mayor of Clonmel, and that he can be a leader, and that people can be, you know, can be harmed, but also can feel strong enough to stand up and lead others to try and call for change. So I think the other thing he does is he says, well, actually, you know, the abuse is one thing, but the way I was treated by the state and the commission and the redress board is another thing. And that was a further compounding of the original trauma. And so I think, you know, that's the whole point of our course here at Maynooth, is to actually try to unpack the whys and wherefores of why abuse happened in the first place, and the context and the ways in which it was allowed to continue. And often that is silence. And then looking at the harms, but also looking at then the ways in which the state can better respond to adults when they come forward.
On that point of people feeling silenced and voiceless, the signing of a non-disclosure agreement that Michael O'Brien back in 2018 said that he was going to, not having heard, I suppose, words to his satisfaction from the Pope, that he was going to, you know, pursue and root out people who had not only abused but covered up abuse. He said he was disappointed with that, and his next step was going to be to write to the Taoiseach to have his non-disclosure agreement waived so he could name his abuser and say how much he got in compensation.
Yeah.
I mean, the role of a non-disclosure agreement for people who have suffered in institutions, is it further harm?
I think it's a further silencing and a further form of control of people at a time when they are trying to take back control of their experience and who they share it with. It's absolutely essential that someone who's undergone an experience of abuse and rape is able to take control of who they tell their story, their experience to, who they choose to share it with. And that non-disclosure agreement that you're talking about is effectively a legal bar on anyone talking about their experience at the redress board, that's actually contained in the legislation setting up the redress board.
And was it ever waived? I mean, to your knowledge, was anyone freed from the obligation to abide by that non-disclosure clause and be able to talk about the compensation or indeed to name their abuser?
So I don't know for 100% for sure, but I don't think it was possible for people to waive it, which is kind of the scenario which might be in the case that wasn't actually in the legislation. So the point is, the Oireachtas, the government, the the Dáil decided to actually put down in legislation a bar on people talking about their experience. So it wasn't just an agreement between private parties that you might revisit. It was a bar. Now, there's, you know, there are good reasons to suspect that it wouldn't be enforced. But essentially, there's a legal, there's a criminal penalty attached to it. And that's still the case if you break the order. Now, no, to my knowledge, absolutely no one has ever been investigated, let alone prosecuted for that. And I think it would be highly vulnerable to legal challenge if anyone, if the DPP in the morning decided to do that. And I don't see any world in which they would actually go ahead and prosecute someone. But the fact that it's there is just another layer of silencing for people who are already feeling, you know, really that they're not being treated as they should be, as they're entitled to be under human rights law by the state. So the sooner that that provision, the 2002 Act, is actually, it's kind of, it's colloquially known as a gagging order, but the sooner that that's repealed, the better, I think, for people. But, you know, people just feel hampered, I suppose, in talking about their experience at the redress board now, in writing their own autobiographies, in publishing things on the internet or in speaking to journalists. And that shouldn't be the case. I shouldn't be the person who goes on Lifeline to talk about it. People should feel empowered to talk about their own experience.
Right. But I mean, it is important that, you know, and you know, your primary motivation to ring presumably is the power of Michael O'Brien's words. It's not just an emotional intervention in a television program. It's part
it's
of cracking the you know, the wall and the silence around people's I mean, it's reclaiming the right to speak about your experience.
Absolutely. Nobody owns that apart from the person themselves. And, you know, it is, we often talk about like teachable moments in teaching, in university lecturing. And that's an extremely powerful moment when the students actually listen. And the fact that he's a man and a middle-aged man, I think, adds to it. There's a certain sense of, well, wow, that's not who I would have thought of as, I mean, you know, as students would have thought of as maybe the typical sexual violence survivor. Of course, it actually is quite often.
There's no such thing as a typical sexual violence survivor.
But we know that many men were sexually abused in the industrial schools, and that boys, unfortunately, still are every day sexually abused. So, But it's just for that, the power of that, of somebody speaking up like that and the courage it took, I think it really makes them sit up and think, okay, well, this is how somebody after the commission feels, you know, not before the commission. The commission's finished now and this is how he's feeling. And he's still feeling it, as you heard, in 2011. So I think as a society and as lawmakers, we have to think about what we're actually doing here when we say we're doing justice and redress for survivors of institutional abuse. There are ways of doing trauma-informed justice that I think that might be, that are much more powerful.
Has the state's response improved?
Well, since then we've had the McAleese Commission and we've had the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes. The most recent one is the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes. I think the basically the short answer is no. I think there has been a lot of disappointment and re-traumatisation on the part of survivors of mother and baby homes in terms of their engagement with that commission, and specifically really how their testimony was treated really by the commission. It wasn't given the credibility and authority it deserved, and their testimony was talked about in the language of stories rather than testimony or experience or source of information or knowledge. And I think that sidelining of people's experiences has been really damaging. I mean, you probably know this already, but survivors weren't given, in the Mother and Baby Home Commission report, weren't given a copy of that report before it was made public. They were, you know, they, it's people who were directly implicated, identifiable in the report, weren't actually given a copy of it before it was published. And so Philomena Lee, who will be known to many people as Philomena from the film with Steve Coogan, and Mary Harney, who's an academic activist and survivor of an industrial school as well, actually.
Judy Dench, who played her so well.
She played Philomena Lee. Yeah, exactly. And Mary Harney as well. Others indeed had to take a case to the High Court to try to actually enforce their rights under the Commission of Investigation Act 2004 to actually have a copy of that report before it was published. Some of the religious orders, to my knowledge, who were named in the report were actually provided with a copy of it before publication. So we still have an imbalance in the treatment of people who come before the commissions, rather than having a victim-centred approach, which is what we need.
I mean, there's another tragedy that strikes you when you listen to Michael O'Brien's story. He went on and he married very happily. And he reared a family. And again, condolences to his children as they come to terms with his death today. But his own father, when he became widowed, was not deemed to be somebody who could parent children, single men, were not left to parent boys and girls, and they were taken off them by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children and placed in Ferry House. You know, and Michael O'Brien was clearly a fine man despite his experiences. And, you know, his father was never given the chance to be a family man and to have avoided the experiences that his family were ultimately put through.
I should say as well, absolutely, my condolences to Michael's family and his children in particular. This is part of the ongoing conversation, I think, that we need to have around how the state engages with people who have been institutionalized in industrial schools, modern baby homes, or indeed psychiatric institutions as well, and how the state treated single parent families is just in the past is a big part of this. I mean, there's so many lessons that we can learn for today, and one of them being that absolutely his father should have been supported.
All right.
Should have been supported. And there wasn't even a single parent kind of allowance, really, at that time. There was no state structures there to help with that happening.
Yeah, so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that somebody who found themselves to be a single parent would find themselves in poverty, and therefore the intervention by the so-called cruelty man carried more weight because there were questions over how they would sustain and support children as a single parent.
But that situation could have been dealt with by the state in a very different way.
And wasn't.
Yeah.
We have a former student of yours on the line who did that course. Caoimhe McGuinness, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You're listening to your former professor, Sinead Ring, there. Did you do that course?
There. Yeah, I did that course about two or three years ago, I did the LLM Masters in International Justice and I took up her module, and I found it really interesting because we got to look at each institution and how the state responded to it. And before I did the module, I knew a little bit about what occurred, but when I did that module, I really understood what occurred and what way the state responded to it. And I was actually shocked of what occurred, and I found Michael O'Brien truly inspiring, the way he spoke on that show, because for the part of the module we had to do an assignment on we had to look at the state response to we had to pick an institution and we had to look at the state response to it, and I picked the institutions, the boys' institutions, and I found that it was the way that the Ryan report spoke was quite skewed to comparison as the way Michael spoke on that TV programme. You could really feel his emotion and what he actually went through.
And do you mind me asking, Caoimhe, obviously, you know, you didn't see Michael O'Brien speaking on questions and answers back in 2009, this for you is something that was coming from another era. So what was your reaction? Do you remember sitting in the class that day and watching this and what the impact was on you?
I actually felt quite emotional. Even when I watched it again this morning, I was like, saw in the news that he passed away. It actually brought, like, it brings tears to your eyes when you actually watch it, because you can actually feel the emotion when he speaks. And he shouldn't have, like, the way he was saying that he had to be cross-examined by 7 barristers, he shouldn't have been put through that, because the way he spoke was truly, like, inspiring, unbelievable. And he really stood up to the state and represented a lot of victims.
And what was it about, you know, the emotion or the delivery, do you think, that caught you and made you emotional to that point?
The way he spoke, you could actually picture in your mind what he was being subjected to. And the way that he was saying that someone like a holy person who came from Rome told him that he wasn't telling the truth, like, broke my heart, because the way he depicted everything, you could picture it in your mind. It was, like, quite believable. And that brought emotion, if you get where I'm coming from.
Yeah. And Sinead Ring, you know, people enter into an adversarial legal system when they come forward, like Michael O'Brien. They go to maybe a commission expecting their experiences to be heard. They expect to be validated. And, you know, his experience was he was put through an adversarial ringer.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, in fairness, when the government set up the Ryan Commission, the Commission to Inquire into Child Abuse in 2000, was originally chaired by Mary LaFoy, a judge, and then it was taken later, Mr Justice Ryan took over. When they set it up, they designed it in an interesting way, because they had two kind of fora. So they had a confidential confidential committee, which was supposed to be a space for listening to people's experiences. And then they had an investigation committee, which was about finding out what happened. And the problem with the investigation committee was that it went fully adversarial. In fact, it was actually in some ways more adversarial than if you went down the courts in the morning and sued somebody, because you didn't, the survivor who was giving testimony didn't get full disclosure of the papers and the documents relating to the case, relating to their experience of abuse. It was, you know, which they would have been entitled to in a court case under the rules of
discovery.
Whereas in this, in the commission, the records were owned by the institutions. The lawyers for the institutions and the state would have had easy access, really, to all of the records pertaining to the individual. And any statements made that might have been, you know, questioned by the survivor, any statements made by representatives of either the state, the Department of Education or other departments, or the various religious organisations that were represented, that couldn't be effectively, I would argue, contested by survivors giving evidence, because it was really a case of they were the only ones being cross-examined. They were the only ones, that's not entirely true, but the focus was on them, and certainly survivors didn't have access to discovery of documents on the other side. One of the main things was, as Caoimhe mentioned there, that many people were subjected to cross-examination by multiple lawyers who were representing various different parties taking part in it. And really that could have been managed in a different way. I think they could have identified issues and managed it more effectively. But to treat people in that kind of traditional adversarial, hostile way in an inquiry situation, I think it needs to be looked at again. There's ways of doing it that are effective in terms of getting at the truth, but also not re-traumatising people and treating them as if they're, inherently suspicious.
Okay.
I think that's That's deeply worrying.
Stay with us if you can, because we are going to take a short break. Thanks to Richie Molloy and indeed Caoimhe McGuinness, who were speaking to us earlier. We're back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.